Pay ratios on the program today, how they may or may not matter in the grand scheme of things. We'll do a check-in from Athens, Greece, and we'll go to New Orleans as well to talk banking and rebuilding. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Wednesday, the 5th day of August. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. The through line for the first part of the program today might best be characterized as a random walk through the American workplace in two chapters, paychecks and perks. Item number one, executive compensation. This morning, the Securities and Exchange Commission voted 3-2 to require that most publicly traded companies disclose what the CEO makes relative to the compensation for a median worker at that company. That would be, of course, median compensation for a worker at that company. The rule was 5 years in the making. It was part of the Dodd-Frank financial reforms passed after the crisis. And depending on who you talk to, it's either going to help keep compensation packages in check for the people in the corner office, or it's going to be completely useless. That's where Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson starts us off.
Publicly traded companies already disclose just how fat their CEO paychecks are. So what will this new data tell us that we didn't already know? Lawrence Michel is president of the Economic Policy Institute.
It's important to put numbers in context. And I think using a CEO to worker pay ratio provides the right context for understanding how extraordinary CEO pay has become in recent decades.
EPI's research shows that in the 1960s, CEOs made roughly 20 times as much as the typical worker. Michel says it's now up around 300. He thinks investors, workers, and all the rest of us should know that and be able to follow changes over time. But Amy Hutton, a professor at Boston College, says this ratio has become very politicized.
People will use this measure when it's reported to make whichever argument they wish to make.
Either to complain that CEO pay is too high or to justify the ratio if it's in line with competitors. Plus, Hutton says companies that outsource work may look better in this statistic than companies that actually hire workers.
I don't know that this really tells us very much about whether or not CEO pay is appropriate.
Nora McCord with Stephen Hall & Partners is an executive compensation consultant.
I have one client who was considering awarding a toaster to the median employee.
That's how random they thought this was. McCord thinks tracking CEO pay against company performance is a better way to judge if the boss is worth their millions. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
All right, item two, the benefits part of pay and benefits packages. The tech sector is known for being quite generous with its benefits. Case in today's point, Netflix, which is going to start offering unlimited parental leave in the first 12 months after an employee has a child. It applies to both men and women for both births and adoptions. Microsoft quickly moved to boost its paid leave for new parents today as well. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more on the part of the compensation package that does not come in plain old dollars and cents.
When I called the Orrick Law Firm, they told me the person I should really talk to about their 9 months of parental leave was out on maternity leave. So instead, I spoke with Chief Administrative Officer Laura Sacklad, who told me the policies about recruitment and competitiveness.
We compete with tech sector companies. We compete with major corporations, all who hire lawyers. And we want to make sure that we have an attractive offering to those individuals.
Like fancy cafeterias, gyms, and services that make it oh so easy to stay at work as long as possible. But Bruce Elliott of the Society for Human Resource Management says we shouldn't be too jealous.
Silicon Valley will act as an incubator, you know, with regard to how they'll manage traditional benefits. And then we'll see, you know, the rest of the country kind of follow.
Free massages at work for everyone?
The rest of the world probably, unless they're very, very successful companies, won't be offering this anytime soon.
Buzzkill, courtesy of John Challenger of job search firm Challenger, Gray and Christmas. But he does add the attention makes companies reevaluate their own packages, especially with low unemployment.
Companies are competing for people, and so you start to see more interesting perks.
And rather than the BMWs handed out during the dot-com boom, he says this round is a bit more realistic, like more time to spend with a new baby. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The wage gap and income inequality and all the issues that fall under those two broad headings are going to be electoral fodder for the next, 15 months or so, and will perhaps be on the list of questions at tomorrow night's GOP debate, about which, by the way, watch it with us. Why don't you? We're going to put on a second screen thing at marketplace.org. I'll be live tweeting there. Our reporters and editors will be reacting to the debate in real time, giving a little context. Join us if you can. Again, it's marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, two up, one down. Details, numbers, you know the drill. Ten years after Katrina, the city of New Orleans has mostly been rebuilt. Putting the tens of thousands of homes and businesses back together, though, required, among many other things, access to capital, as the bankers like to say, loans and lenders willing to make them. That hasn't always been a universal thing in New Orleans. There are neighborhoods in that city that have struggled for decades with disinvestment and high poverty rates and a distinct lack of banks. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Noel King has the story of how one small financial institution changed that.
This New Orleans story starts 180 miles north in Jackson, Mississippi. Bill Bynum, the CEO of Hope Credit Union, walks into one of his branches. He says hello to his employees.
How you doing?
Good morning.
Hola, ¿cómo está?
Muy bien, usted.
All I've got today.
One of his workers, Laura Vasquez, tells him good news. She's pregnant. A customer overhears that and says, congratulations. Bynum slides over and introduces himself.
How you doing? I'm Bill.
I'm Jackie Horner.
Horner tells him she banked somewhere else for a while, but she's back.
Glad you came back home.
Welcome home.
And then I brought my mom. She's a member, too. And then brought my brother.
That's good. Well, so hopefully we're treating you right.
And then my baby's son, he just started a new job. So
you can almost see Bynum doing the math. That's three new members for an organization that has grown one member at a time. Bynum started the credit union at his church in Jackson 21 years ago. The first members were people he shared a pew with. Today, Hope has 31,000 members and nearly $300 million in assets. It might seem small, but it lends and invests in low-income, high-poverty communities, places often forgotten by traditional banks. We head into Bynum's office.
Come on back. Can I get you anything?
Where there are a couple of striking pictures on the walls. There are two of him with U.S. presidents that he's advised, Clinton and Obama. He also advised George W. Bush. And there's a picture of a ramshackle little house with a rusted tin roof and a collapsing front porch. He spotted it one day, and it reminds him of his mission.
It is frustrating to drive through the Delta and through low-income communities and see street corner after street corner, shopping strip after shopping strips littered with payday lenders, with check cashers, with financial predators, but no bank to be found.
He says where there are no banks, there are no mortgages, no small business loans, no investment. And Hope's mission has taken it beyond the Delta. Bynum was invited to open a branch in New Orleans by a church in that city. Hope opened 8 months before Hurricane Katrina hit. It's in Central City, a low-income, predominantly African-American neighborhood, the kind of place where some families have lived for generations.
Please come in. Beats the heat, don't it?
Sandra Reed is one of those people. Her memories of the city's destruction are still fresh.
There was no sound. There were no crickets. There were no birds. There was no life. And this city always has life. There's always a sound of something going on in this city. My family ended up in Baton Rouge for a while, and at that point I was raising a 15-year-old granddaughter. And one day she was sitting in the sidewalk, and she was ever so sad. And I said, well, what's the matter, B? She said, listen, there is nothing to hear here.
Reed is a member of the credit union. She was one of a group of residents who pushed Hope to open on Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard in Central City. When Hope opened, there hadn't been a bank in Central City for 40 years. Reed says that put people here at a real disadvantage. She says people in higher income parts of New Orleans.
And they can walk into a bank and say, well, how you doing, Cyrus? And Cyrus says, well, I'm doing good, Mr. Joe. And says, I need to talk to you a little bit about some money. And they say, well, come on over to my desk. And before it's over, it's a handshake and a cigar, and they're out the door. What Hope offered us was an opportunity to have that kind of personalized relationship.
When she walks into Hope,
and they say, hey, Ms. Reed. I say, hey. I say, I came to pay my bill. That's what I get. I'm Cyrus, and he's Joe.
She took out a second mortgage with Hope after Katrina to make home repairs. Today, you can see Hope's presence on O.C. Haley, the Cultural Arts Center, the nonprofit office space, the Mexican restaurant, a forthcoming grocery store. Hope provided financing for all of them. The credit union also has some critics. Lynette White Colon was the branch manager when Katrina hit. She was displaced in Dallas, but even 8 months after opening, she'd developed great relationships with Hope members. One of them was a New Orleans police officer.
I texted him to say, you know, I know things are really bad in the city, but if you get a chance to go by the credit union. So within an hour, he sent me a text back saying, everything's good, your boards are still up, and you're looking really good.
The branch got lucky. No flooding, no looting. White Colon went back to work, visiting churches, FEMA shelters. She says Hope was great at making small recovery loans, a little bit of money for necessities like shelter. But for bigger stuff, like home loans, she says Hope was too slow, too conservative. She'd have 30 or 40 loan applications piled up at a time.
I have to see these people every day. I go in the supermarket and I see them. I go in the mall, I go to church, I see them. They entrusted me to take a loan application and it's taking 6 months and they still don't have an answer. And these are people who are very credit worthy.
White Colon left Hope in 2007. Bill Bynum says he gets her criticism. He says because of the chaos, a lot of people were missing the things you need to get a loan, like their financial documents. And he says it pushed the credit union to grow. In the 18 months after the storm, Hope went from 55 employees to 150. That meant there were people in place when, 3 years later, the rest of the country was hit by another kind of disaster, the financial crisis.
People couldn't get access to basic banking services. And so we decided we would use the infrastructure and capacity that we put in place to address the spread of bank deserts across the Mid-South.
So Hope's been opening branches in towns that have few or no banks. Bynum likes to cite a Bloomberg study from 2 years ago. It found more than 1,800 bank branches had closed since the recession, 93% of them in low-income communities. In that same time, Hope has tripled in size, expanding from 7 branches to 24. In New Orleans, I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Alexis Tsipras, the Greek prime minister, said today he is about this close to finalizing the latest European bailout package. $96.3 billion will be the total amount of the financing, a deal that was agreed to while we happened to be in Athens 3 weeks ago. One of the people we talked to while we were there was a woman named Olga Karastati. She runs a bakery and a cafe. She's the one who said to me, if you remember this, if you've only got €5 in your pocket, why not spend it on a good cup of coffee? Anyway, we've got her back on the phone to see what's new over there. Hi, Olga.
Hello, Kai. How are you?
I'm well. It's been a while. How are you? How you been?
I'm fine. Actually, I'm on vacation right now in the island of Serifos, in a friend's house.
That's nice. It's good to get out of Athens. But let me ask you about the bakery, though. I hate to take you back to work, but how's business been?
The situation remains the same. Nothing has changed yet for the real economy.
Who's coming to your cafe nowadays? Who's coming to your bakery? Is it tourists or is it locals?
Locals and now some tourists. During August, businesses decreased because, you know, when you came, it was hot. In August, it's hotter. So the tourists are visiting mostly the islands or other parts of Athens.
One of the things you and I talked about when I was there was that, you know, you're not making a whole lot of money in the cafe, but you're doing it in the hopes that things are eventually going to get better. Do you still believe that? Do you still believe it's going to get better?
You know, if Greece makes major reforms and, of course, prevents fraud up to high level, then I guess things can start getting better for all of us, not for only my shop.
How much longer do you think you're going to be able to hold on to your business, though, if you're not making any money?
I don't know, a year.
You think a year?
Yes, yes.
And then what will you do? I mean, if you go out of business, what are you going to do?
I don't know. I don't want to think about it right now. You know, I want to focus in my business and how to get things better. For example, I intend to add some more products And of course, I have a job for you. You can advertise me in the U.S. so I can be worldwide famous.
That's right. Olga, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. And maybe we'll call you soon and we'll check.
Thank you. And hope to see you again in Greece.
Yes, me too. Okay. All right, Olga. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Coming up.
It was almost like the nerdy version of Oprah, but it sold a ton of books.
It was way funnier, too. Jon Stewart and the Amazon author rankings. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 10 points today, less than a tenth percent, 17,540 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained 34 points, two-thirds percent, 5139. The S&P 500 up 6 points, three-tenths percent, 2099. We told you earlier about Netflix and its new paternity leave policy. The stock added 2%. Priceline priced up more than 5% the day after reported earnings that beat expectations. Not happily ever after earnings for Disney, by the by. Yesterday, the company cut its forecast for future TV revenue. That's a big TV company. And so Disney slumped 9%. Time Warner also fell 9% today. Comcast off about 5%. The solar company First Solar surged more than 16% after reporting higher than expected sales. Apple entered positive territory today after five straight days of losses. The stock up two-thirds of 1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. What does the remainder of the Atlantic hurricane season look like? The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration releases an update. Energizer is scheduled to issue quarterly earnings. And these guys don't run on batteries. More than 50,000 rubber ducks are dropped into the Chicago River for the Windy City Rubber Ducky Derby, a fundraiser for Special Olympics Illinois. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You remember the Game of Thrones season premiere a couple of months ago and how HBO was rolling out a new streaming service as part of that premiere and how that service turned out to be a smashing success? Now, what if I told you that HBO and a whole lot of other companies have Major League Baseball to thank for that slice of their success? It's true. Ben Popper tells the tale in a new article for The Verge. Ben, it's good to have you on.
Oh, my pleasure.
This is kind of a wild story. You have to help me understand how Major League Baseball's IT team basically wound up, as you say in the beginning, in the opening story of this piece, running HBO Now for HBO or building it.
Sure. So it is a crazy story, and it covers about 15 years. Way back in 2000, the then commissioner, Bud Selig, decided they needed to centralize the digital rights of baseball. They didn't want small market teams and big market teams to have websites of varying quality, right? Yeah. And they wanted to understand what the internet was and to own, you know, those digital assets and make the most of them. So, you know, that was a bumpy road. But one of the things they did extremely early on in 2000 was they said, hey, let's live stream a game. Let's see if we can get a video broadcast and put it on the internet. And it looked terrible. It looked like a flip book. but it worked and people were interested. And starting in spring training of 2003, they sold MLB.TV. And that was the first, you know, live streaming product that was sold like that. It was the first major league or sport of any kind to do that. And so super early on, they were learning this technology.
The teams chipped in X amount of dollars, right? So everybody had a stake and has a stake.
Yeah, the 30 teams each own, you know, an equal percent. And they each agreed to give $1 million for 4 years. And MLB Advanced Media, which they shortened to BAM. Is, they struggled a little bit at the beginning, but by the time, you know, they launched MLB.TV, they had kind of realized what they were onto with streaming. And shortly thereafter, they were cash flow positive, and they've been paying the league owners a dividend ever since. So an interesting approach to make it like a startup and keep them honest by saying you got to, you know, sink or swim on your own P&L.
Right. But now they are somebody, right? They are building or have built HBO Now. As we said, they've got a partnership with the National Hockey League. They're doing all kinds of stuff. Why doesn't Major League Baseball spin these guys off, you know, maintain a stake, but spin it off and really let them run with it?
So, yeah, you nailed it. That's the plan. They have become the preeminent technology company in the live streaming space. You know, they power WWE, they power HBO, they power ESPN. They did the World Cup when they set new records for concurrent streams and for total streams. So they are the go-to guys when it comes to build me a live streaming service or even, you know, over-the-top video on demand like HBO.
Right.
And so the idea now is that the ownership structure is a little bit constraining. They can't, you know, easily raise outside capital because the league owners don't want somebody to own a piece of baseball, essentially, the IT team. So they're going to spin it out, and the first investor is the NHL, which is this strange partnership that was announced yesterday. Or the first investor, sorry.
Right. You know, so the news today is Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney, saying that he could spin off ESPN and not spin it off, but put it over the top, you know, sort of cut the cord and do all that. How much do you think BAM and Major League Baseball has contributed to the way we now are starting to think about television?
I think the best way to think about it is the adage that Netflix put forward, you know, we want to become HBO faster than they can become us. I think you could say the same thing about BAM and ESPN. ESPN wants to spin off and start selling itself a la carte. Well, BAM is currently the company that powers the technology they use for streaming. So I think the atmosphere you see with all of the media companies right now is one of fear, justifiably so, because the cable industry, the pay TV industry, is in an accelerating decline. And they know they have to move over to this new, you know, universe where any screen that's connected to the internet is where you need to be. On the other hand, most of their revenues are still in the old world. So it's a scary time, and that is what makes BAM so interesting. They've navigated that world. They have partners on both sides, and I think they've played the game of having partners old and new without offending anyone kind of perfectly.
Maybe this is just me, but it does sort of seem like BAM is the really well-kept secret of live streaming. I mean, I'm sure everybody in the industry knew about it, but regular people are like, wait, MLB and streaming and what?
Right. I think that's part of the magic is like regular people don't care. They just want it to work. You know, they want to turn on the TV and they want the stream not to buffer. When it's the Game of Thrones premiere, like it can't fail.
Ben Popper, he's the business editor at The Verge. Great piece on the site right now about BAM, Major League Baseball Advanced Media. Ben, thanks very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
With just a day left of his run on The Daily Show, you know who might wind up missing Jon Stewart most of all? Book publicists, that's who, especially the ones plugging serious nonfiction books. Lengthy interviews with those kinds of authors have been a surprisingly regular feature on The Daily Show. Just last week, Doris Kearns Goodwin talking about her book on Lyndon Johnson, David McCullough about his biography of the Wright brothers. Stewart welcomed unknown writers on unsexy topics like, I don't know, transportation infrastructure, just to say one. And when he did, those books started selling. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has more.
In publishing, the Jon Stewart effect is a well-known phenomenon.
As a publicist, you know, having someone on The Daily Show was a very, very big deal.
That's Kathleen Schmidt. She's vice president of publicity and marketing for Running Press.
It was almost like the nerdy version of Oprah, but it sold a ton of books.
One key: Stewart has assembled a broad audience. I mean, your mom will still see those authors getting interviewed on Charlie Rose. Your kids, not so much.
Right. And I love Charlie Rose. But, you know, I'm also in a different age demographic.
Daniel Okrent experienced the Jon Stewart effect firsthand.
I am a writer, a journalist and historian, and my most recent book was Last Call, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition.
He'd been tracking the book sales.
The Amazon bestseller list is the thing that you keep, if you have a book out, that you keep on reloading. You know, you get hypertrophied thumbs.
By the time he went on The Daily Show, the book had been out for 3 months. It had peaked and dropped back to maybe 200 on that list. Then, the Stewart effect.
And I shot up to, I think it was 17, and that includes everything from fiction, nonfiction, the Bible, Garfield. It doesn't make any difference. I think among what I would call real books, I was number 7 or 8.
Jon Stewart wasn't alone. When Stephen Colbert was on Comedy Central with Stewart, he also did a lot for writers. Colbert helped a book about quantum physics reach a huge audience. And he'll be back on the air in the fall on CBS. We'll just have to see how many physicists he books. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weisman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I believe I've already expressed my dismay at the prospect of taking Alexander Hamilton off the $10 bill, as Treasury Secretary Jack Lew has been talking about doing. If that does come to pass, however, it does raise the question of who should replace him. A new poll out from Marist has some suggestions. In order from the top, it goes like this. Eleanor Roosevelt polled at 27%. Then Harriet Tubman, Sacagawea, the woman who made Lewis and Clark possible. Amelia Earhart, Susan B. Anthony was there. Also, Sandra Day O'Connor came in sixth, but she can't be on it yet. The winner has got to be dead, Secretary Lew said. I'm good with all of them, I think, but you should let us know. Hit us up on our Facebook page. It's Marketplace APM or Twitter at Marketplace. Tell us who you like. Ten points to the downside on the Dow today. That is less than a 10%. The NASDAQ up 34 points, 2/3%. The S&P 500 picked up 6 points, about 0.3% there. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.